Welcome to this deep dive. Before we jump in, a quick thanks to our sponsor, CertFuel. They've got a full Series 63 course with, adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted exactly like the real thing. Check them out at CertFuel.com.
Yeah, they really do a great job breaking this stuff down.
They absolutely do. Okay, so I want you to imagine a medical x-ray for a second. Usually, when we talk about a medical diagnosis, there's this comforting expectation of just, like, total precision, right?
Right, yeah. It's binary.
Exactly. It's basically engineering. Mm-hmm. You fall off your bike, you break your arm, they take an x-ray, and you see that jagged white line on the screen. The doctor points a pen at it and just says, hey, there it is.
Broken or not broken. It's very clear-cut. Safe or not safe. We like things to be perfectly categorized.
We really do. But then you step into the world of state securities regulation, and suddenly you realize that x-ray machine has been broken for decades. You're looking for a clean break, but instead you're getting this muddy watercolor painting.
Oh, man. It really is notorious for being murky, especially when you are preparing for the Series 63 exam. You think you know the rules, and then they throw a curveball.
It is the absolute definition of diagnostic muddy waters.
Yeah.
And today, our mission in this deep dive is surviving one of the most heavily tested, highest stakes sections of that entire landscape.
Yes, we are talking about exempt securities, exempt transactions, and the power of the state to revoke them.
Right. And if you are listening to this right now, you are likely in the trenches of exam prep. You are probably staring at paragraphs of legalese that just blur together. But we are going to get you through it.
We definitely are. And, you know, the reason this specific section feels so muddy, the reason the exam writers absolutely love to trap you here, is that they constantly intentionally mix up what a security actually is with how it is sold.
Right. They blur those lines on purpose.
Exactly. They want to see if you are actually paying attention to the underlying definitions or if you are just, memorizing flashcards without understanding the actual mechanics.
So by the end of this deep dive, you are not just going to recognize these rules. You are going to understand the why behind them so deeply that those tricky paragraph-long exam questions won't stand a chance.
That's the goal.
And to do this, because standard dry textbook lectures are just the enemy of retention, mm-hmm. especially if your brain tends to wander, like mine, we are bringing in a recurring cast of characters today to test these rules in real time. We're going to build a little universe.
Honestly, I think that's the only way to do it. You have to take the abstract rules and make them concrete. Give them faces.
Totally. So let's introduce the cast. First up, we have Frank the founder.
Ah, Frank.
Yes, Frank is a well-meaning but incredibly chaotic entrepreneur. He is desperately trying to fund his startup, which manufactures high-speed hoverboards for dogs.
A true visionary, a man ahead of his time. But structurally speaking, an absolute regulatory nightmare waiting to happen.
Oh, a total disaster. Next, we have Reckless Rick. Now, Rick is a registered broker-dealer who spends literally all of his free time looking for loopholes.
If there is a gray area in the law, Rick is setting up a camping tent right in the middle of it and trying to charge admission.
Every regulator's worst headache. Which brings us to our third character. Prudent Penny.
Prudent Penny. She is the state administrator. She is the law.
She brings the hammer down when Frank or Rick step out of line. She is all about investor protection. She does not sleep. And she has zero sense of humor about securities fraud.
She is terrifying, and we absolutely love her.
We do. And finally, we have our standard retail investor, Dave. Dave just wants to make a little money. He's a bit gullible. He trusts his neighbors. And he just keeps getting caught in the crossfire of these complex financial schemes.
A perfect cast. So let's start with the absolute foundation. If you take nothing else away from this entire discussion, let it be this framework. Under the Uniform Securities Act, there are only three lawful paths to offer or sell a security in a state. There are three doors.
Okay, let's paint those doors. What are they?
Door number one is that the security is formally registered with the state. This means filing mountains of paperwork, paying hefty fees, and getting Prudent Penny's explicit approval.
Sounds exhausting. What's door number two?
Door number two is that the security or the transaction is exempt. It basically has a special hall pass to bypass state registration entirely.
Okay. Registered, exempt, and door number three.
Door number three is that it is a federal covered security. That means the federal government, like the SEC, has taken jurisdiction and state registration is just preempted.
Registered, exempt, federal covered. That is it.
There is no secret fourth door.
Okay. I am going to ask you, the listener, a direct question right now. Think about this for a second. If Frank the founder tries to sell you stock in his dog hoverboard company, and you check, and it is not registered, it is not federal covered, and it doesn't qualify for any exemption, What is it?
I'll give you a hint. Prudent Penny is already putting her boots on.
Seriously, take a beat. Answer it in your head. Okay, it is 100% unlawful. It is illegal. You cannot just invent a reason to sell stock because you really believe in dog overboard.
Oh, yeah, you have to walk through one of those three doors.
Now, today, we are hyper-focusing on that middle door, the exemptions, because this is where the Series 63 makes its money.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about the difference between an exempt security and an exempt transaction.
This is the core tension of the entire exam right here.
Yeah.
An exempt security is based on the nature of the security itself. It is based on what it is, like who issued it, how stable are they?
Okay, and the transaction?
An exempt transaction is based entirely on the manner of the sale. How is it being sold? Who is buying it?
Let's lock this in with an analogy. This is the mechanism you need to hold in your head for the next hour. Think of an exempt security like having diplomatic immunity. It's a diplomatic passport.
I like that.
Right. That exemption travels with the security everywhere it goes, forever, no matter who sells it or how they sell it. U.S. Treasury bonds have diplomatic immunity. They are exempt securities. They cross borders freely.
Right. If you hold a U.S. Treasury bond, you have that passport. It's baked into the paper. But an exempt transaction is entirely different. It is not a passport.
What is it, then?
An exempt transaction is like a one-night VIP backstage pass to a concert.
I love this. Walk us through the backstage pass.
It only makes that specific sale legal for that specific moment in time. The bouncer lets you backstage for Tuesday night. But if the person who bought that security wants to turn around and resell it the next day to someone else, they need a brand new VIP pass.
Oh, wow. So it doesn't stick with the security at all.
Exactly. The exemption does not travel with the security. It lives and dies with that one specific transaction.
Diplomatic passport versus one night backstage pass. That is your anchor. Do not forget it. Now, before we hand out the passports and the backstage passes, we have to talk about the exam trap to end all exam traps.
Mm-hmm.
The rule that overrides literally everything.
Oh, the anti-fraud rule. Yes, please, everybody, listen carefully to this. Exemptions do not exempt you from anti-fraud rules.
Let me repeat that because it sounds like a paradox, but it is the most important rule on the books.
Yeah.
There are absolutely zero exemptions from fraud.
None. Zero. The state administrator, Prudent Penny, she retains full anti-fraud jurisdiction over everything in her state.
Registered security.
She can bust you for fraud.
Exempt securities.
Fraud jurisdiction.
Exempt transaction.
Fraud jurisdiction. Even federal covered securities, which she legally cannot force to register, she still retains the power to prosecute if you commit fraud in her state.
Let's bring in our characters to see what this looks like in practice. Let's say Frank the founder decides to pivot. Dog hoverboards are failing, so he gets his hands on some highly safe, completely exempt U.S. government bonds. He has the diplomatic passport.
Okay, good for Frank.
Right. But then he goes to Dave, our gullible retail investor, and says, hey, Dave, buddy, buy these government bonds for me. They yield 50% a year guaranteed,
mm-hmm.
and the paper they are printed on actually cures male pattern baldness.
Okay, so let's break down the x-ray on this one. The security is a U.S. government bond. It is an exempt security. It has the passport. It does not need to be registered with Prudent Penny.
So Frank is good to go.
Right.
The security is exempt.
Wrong. Frank is absolutely going to jail.
Because he lied.
Because he lied. He committed fraud in connection with the sale of a security. The fact that the security itself didn't need to be registered is completely irrelevant to the fact that he lied to Dave about the 50% yield and the baldness cure.
It's totally separate.
It is. If you lie, cheat, or steal in connection with the sale of any security, you violate the Uniform Securities Act, period.
It seems obvious when we talk about it like this, but I promise you, the exam will try to trick you. They're going to write a massive, convoluted, like 100-word paragraph about how Reckless Rick perfectly executed an exempt transaction for an exempt security.
Oh, they love doing that.
They really do. They will detail how he followed every single filing rule to the letter, dotted every I, crossed every T, but verbally told the client a tiny little lie about the company's earnings projection. And the question we'll ask, is Rick protected from civil liability because the security was exempt?
And if you fall for the distraction of the perfect paperwork, you get it wrong. The answer is always, always no. Fraud is fraud. The anti-fraud provisions are the ultimate safety net.
Okay, one more foundational piece of architecture before we get to the specific lists. The burden of proof. Let's say Reckless Rick gets caught selling completely unregistered stock in Frank's hoverboard company. Prudent Penny kicks down his door and says, Rick, you are selling unregistered securities.
She caught him red-handed.
Exactly. But Rick throws his hands up and says, "Whoa, Penny, you can't find me. That sale to Dave, that was an isolated non-issuer transaction. It's an exempt transaction. I had a backstage pass."
And prudent Penny is just going to look at him and say, "Prove it."
Wait, really? What about innocent until proven guilty? Does the state have to prove he didn't have an exemption?
No. And this is a critical distinction for the exam. In securities law, the burden of proof is always on the person claiming the exemption. Prudent Penny does not have to prove that he is guilty of an illegal sale by proving no exemption existed.
So she just has to prove a sale happened.
Exactly. She only has to prove he sold an unregistered security. The moment she proves that, the ball is entirely in Rick's court. Rick has to affirmatively prove, with documentation and evidence, that his sale fit perfectly into the specific exemption he is claiming.
I want to push back on that, though. Why? Why does the administrator get to just point a finger and make you do all the homework? That feels a bit, you know, stacked against the citizen.
Well, it is entirely about regulatory efficiency and practical reality. Think about it from a logical standpoint. There are dozens of possible exemptions. If the state had to prove a negative, if Prudent Penny had to investigate and definitively prove that the transaction did not qualify for exemption A and did not qualify for exemption B, all the way down the list, enforcement would grind to an absolute halt.
Yeah, she'd spent her entire life just trying to prove what didn't happen.
Exactly. The person who engaged in the transaction is the one who holds all the facts. Rick knows who he sold it to, when, and how. By shifting the burden to the person making the claim, the state ensures that people only claim exemptions when they actually have the paperwork and the facts to back them up. If Rick can't produce the evidence that it was an isolated transaction, he loses.
Okay, that makes sense. It forces the brokers to keep their own house in order. All right, we have our foundation. We know the three doors. We have our passports and our backstage passes. We know fraud is always illegal, and we know you have to bring your own receipts.
Time to open the doors.
Let's dive into the exempt securities. The diplomatic passports. What it is. So we've established that some securities are born with a diplomatic passport. But what actually gets you on that list?
The Uniform Securities Act lists a number of broad categories of securities that are inherently exempt from state registration. And remember, because these are exempt securities, they never lose the status. It travels with them.
We don't need to read the textbook definition of all of them, but we definitely need to deeply understand the mechanics of the ones the exam loves to weaponize against you.
Absolutely.
Let's start with the heavy hitters, government and foreign securities. I think everyone assumes U.S. debt is safe, but let's get into the weeds.
The baseline rule is that securities issued or guaranteed by the U.S. government, any state or any political subdivision of a state, are exempt. This includes U.S. treasuries, obviously, but it also includes municipal bonds.
Okay, let's stop there. Municipal bonds. If the city of Chicago issues a bond to build a new public high school, that's a municipal bond. It is backed by the taxes of the citizens of Chicago. That's called a general obligation bond. That feels very safe. It gets a passport.
Yes, definitely exempt.
But what about revenue bonds? Like, say they issue a bond specifically funded only by the tolls collected on a brand new bridge. If people stop driving and the bridge doesn't get traffic, that bond might default. The city isn't going to raise taxes to pay for it. Is that still exempt?
Yes, it is. And this is exactly where the exam will try to trick you. They will try to suggest that only general obligation bonds, bonds backed by the full taxing power, are exempt because they are safer.
But they're both exempt.
Yes. The rule explicitly states that revenue obligations are included. If a U.S. state or municipality issues it, regardless of whether it's backed by taxes or a toll booth, it has the diplomatic passport.
Got it. Domestic governments are in. Let's look across the borders, because this is a classic exam trap, the side-by-side comparison of Canada versus every other country on planet Earth.
The Uniform Securities Act treats Canada very, very specially. The rule is that securities issued or guaranteed by Canada, any Canadian province, or any political subdivision of a Canadian province are completely exempt.
Full stop. Canada just gets the golden ticket.
Canada gets a free pass, yes. A bond issued by the City of Toronto is treated with the exact same deference as a bond issued by the City of Chicago.
Why? Why Canada and not, say, the UK or Australia?
It comes down to deep historical economic integration and regulatory alignment. The U.S. and Canada have historically had incredibly intertwined financial markets. Back in the 90s, they even established the multi-jurisdictional disclosure system, which basically recognized that each other's regulatory standards were so similar, they could just trust each other. So state regulators just baked Canada into the safe list.
Okay, so Canada is in. But what about everyone else? What if Frank, the founder, decides his dog hoverboard market is completely saturated in North America, and he somehow gets a random foreign country to guarantee his company's debt?
For any other foreign government, there is a massive string attached. The U.S. must currently maintain diplomatic relations with that specific country for their securities to be exempt.
So let's say Frank gets a country that the U.S. is currently friendly with to issue a bond. It's exempt. But then tomorrow, there's a geopolitical crisis, and the U.S. severs all diplomatic ties with that country. What happens?
The exemption vanishes instantly. Prudent Penny would immediately block any further unregistered sales of that bond in her state. The diplomatic passport is literally tied to actual geopolitical diplomatic relations.
That is fascinating. The state law automatically reacts to the State Department. Wait, is that the only condition? What if the country still has relations with the U.S., but they just decide they don't want to pay their debts anymore?
Ah, this is the repudiation trap. There's another crucial condition that applies to all government securities, and this actually includes Canada. The security must be recognized as a valid obligation.
Meaning what? Practically?
Meaning, if a foreign government issues debt, and then a new political regime takes over in a revolution and says, hey, we aren't paying the debt of the old regime, we repudiate it well, it is no longer a valid obligation. If the obligation is repudiated by the issuer, the exemption is gone.
So always exempt is a strong word, even for a passport.
Mm-hmm.
It has to actually be acknowledged as a valid debt by the entity that issued it.
Correct.
Okay, moving on from governments. Let's talk about the next major category, which is financial institutions, banks, savings and loans, credit unions.
The legal philosophy here is really simple. It's redundant regulation. Banks are already aggressively scrutinized by federal banking regulators like the FDIC, the Federal Reserve, and state banking commissions. Making a bank register its own standard securities with Prudent Penny's office would just be a massive waste of taxpayer resources and duplicative paperwork.
Right. So if Chase Bank or a local credit union issues its own stock or its own bonds or certificates of deposit, those are exempt securities, passports all around. But here's the trap. The exam loves to test what we call the conduit trap.
Oh, yeah. This is a classic Reckless Rick move.
Exactly. I'm going to ask you, the listener, a direct question. Think through the logic here. If Dave, the retail investor, buys a bank's own corporate stock, it's exempt. We know that. But what if the bank is just holding some random assets in a vault, acting as a depository, and they issue paper certificates on behalf of a completely different unregistered reorganization committee? Is that paper certificate exempt just because a bank's logo is stamped at the top?
Take a beat to think about it.
The answer is no. Absolutely not.
If the bank is merely acting as a conduit, a middleman, a glorified storage unit, and the security does not represent an actual interest in or a debt of the bank itself, it is not exempt.
Reckless Rick would totally try this. He would take Frank's completely unregistered, highly illegal dog hoverboard stock. He would put it in a safety deposit box at a local, heavily regulated bank. He would have the bank issue a depository receipt for what's in the box. And then Rick would go to Dave and say, look, Dave, it's a bank security. It says bank right here. It's exempt.
And Prudent Penny would see right through it and fine him into oblivion. The bank has to actually be on the hook. The security must be a liability of the bank or equity in the bank for the redundant regulation philosophy to apply.
Mm.
A bank holding your sketchy stock doesn't magically sanitize the stock.
Do not fall for the conduit trap. Okay, let's talk about insurance companies. This is honestly my favorite trap on the entire exam because it feels like a riddle wrapped in a regulatory mystery.
It trips up more candidates than almost anything else in this section.
Let's play a game of true or false. Imagine a massive life insurance company. If they issue common stock to the public to raise capital, is that stock an exempt security?
True, yes. It represents an ownership interest in the heavily regulated insurance company. Exempt.
Okay. If they issue corporate bonds to build a new headquarters?
True, yes. Exempt. Represents a direct debt of the company.
Okay, getting trickier.
Yeah.
What if they sell a fixed annuity contract to Dave?
Trick question. False premise. A fixed annuity isn't even defined as a security under the Uniform Securities Act. It is an insurance product. So exemptions don't even apply because it's not a security to begin with. Prudent Penny has no jurisdiction over a fixed annuity.
But here is where the hammer drops. What if that same insurance company issues a variable annuity or a variable life insurance policy to Dave?
Variable annuities and variable life insurance are not exempt securities. They are defined as securities, and they absolutely must be registered with the state or sold under an exempt transaction. They have no passport.
I want to stop and push back on this because it drives me crazy. Hold on. If an insurance company sells me a fixed annuity and they mismanage their funds and go bankrupt, I still lose my money. Why on earth wouldn't the state administrator want that fixed annuity registered and monitored as a security, just like a variable annuity? That feels like a massive regulatory blind spot. Why do variable products get singled out while fixed products are ignored by securities law?
It is a great question, and understanding this why is the key to remembering it. It all comes down to who holds the investment risk. With a fixed annuity, the insurance company is taking your money, putting it in their general account, and guaranteeing you a specific fixed dollar payout regardless of how the stock market performs.
Okay.
So the insurance company holds all the investment risk. If the market crashes, they still owe you that fixed amount. Because it's an insurance risk, the state insurance commissioner regulates it, not the securities administrator.
So it's about jurisdiction based on risk.
Exactly. But with a variable product, your money goes into a separate, segregated account that is invested in the stock market, basically mutual funds. If the market crashes, your payout crashes. The investment risk is entirely shifted away from the insurance company and placed squarely onto Dave's shoulders.
And whenever Dave bears the market risk, Prudent Penny steps in.
Precisely. Because a variable product is essentially a mutual fund wrapped in an insurance contract, the payout is not fixed in guaranteed dollars. The state demands that these variable products be treated as securities, registered, and accompanied by a prospectus to ensure Dave gets full disclosure of those market risks.
That makes so much sense. So, to recap the insurance riddle, insurance company corporate stocks and bonds, passports, they are exempt. Fixed annuities, not even in the airport, they aren't securities. Variable annuities and variable life. Go wait in the registration line, no passport.
Exactly right.
Okay, let's look at another highly tested category, commercial paper. This is basically short-term corporate IOUs, big companies borrowing money for a few months to make payroll or buy inventory. Now, this one has a very strict checklist. I like to visualize commercial paper as a guy trying to get into an incredibly exclusive nightclub. The bouncer at the door has a clipboard with three rules, and you have to meet all three simultaneously, or you are getting bounced.
The three rules are maturity, denomination, and rating. Let's break them down. First, maturity. The paper must mature in 9 months or less from the date of issuance. That is exactly 270 days.
So very short term only. Rule two is denomination. You can't just borrow a little bit of money. It has to be issued in minimum denominations of $50,000.
And rule three is rating. It must be rated in one of the top three categories by a nationally recognized statistical rating organization like Moody's or S&P. So generally speaking, an A rating or better.
The bouncer checks all three. So let's say Reckless Rick tries to get into the club. He has a corporate promissory note he wants to sell to Dave. It matures in 6 months. Good. It has a AAA rating. Amazing. Yeah. But it's only issued in a $10,000 denomination. What happens?
The bouncer throws him out. It fails the $50,000 test. Because it missed even one requirement, it is not an exempt security. It must be registered.
Okay, what if Frank, the founder, issues a note for $100,000, way over the minimum? Great. He somehow bribes his way to a top rating. But it matures in 12 months.
Thrown out. Exceeds the 9-month maximum. All three conditions must be strictly satisfied.
Now, I want to dig into the why here, especially on that second rule.
Mm-hmm.
Why $50,000? Why not $10,000? It seems weird that the state would say this investment is safe, but only if you are rich enough to buy 50 grand of it.
It is entirely by design. The federal exemption for commercial paper actually only cares about the 9-month limit. But the state regulators, the prudent pennies of the country, added the $50,000 minimum and the top tier rating requirement because they actively want to keep retail investors out of the commercial paper market unless they're dealing with highly secure, large dollar amounts.
Well, why? If it's a top rated company, why shouldn't Dave be able to buy a $1,000 IOU from them?
Because of history. If you look back at corporate bankruptcies, a famous historical example is the Penn Central Railroad bankruptcy in 1970, which completely shocked the financial system. They had millions of dollars in commercial paper outstanding. When a company goes bankrupt, commercial paper is unsecured debt. It is not backed by collateral. It's just a promise.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, if a massive company suddenly collapses, anyone holding that paper gets wiped out. State regulators realize that commercial paper is a market meant for institutional cash management, not for Dave's retirement fund.
So the $50,000 minimum is a moat?
It's a moat. It ensures that the people buying commercial paper are generally institutions or wealthy individuals who can afford to lose the money if the unsecured IOU defaults. They don't want reckless Rick selling $1,000 corporate IOUs to grandmothers who think they're as safe as bank CDs.
That provides so much clarity. It's not arbitrary. It's a deliberate wall to protect retail investors from unsecured corporate default risk. Okay, rounding out our exempt securities list, we have three more. Nonprofits, utilities, and employee benefit plans.
Let's hit utilities first. They are exempt for the exact same reason as banks: redundant regulation. Public utilities are already intensely regulated regarding their rates, their operations, and how they issue securities by state public utility commissions or federal agencies.
So Prudent Penny lets the utility commission handle it. What about nonprofits?
Securities issued by nonprofits are exempt, but there's a huge defining caveat. They must be organized exclusively for religious, educational, benevolent, charitable, or social purposes. Think church building bonds, university bonds. But they must have zero private profit motive. No one can be getting rich off the back end.
Okay, listener, here's an exam trap scenario. Let's say a local church issues bonds to build a massive new sanctuary. The bonds are exempt from registration. They have the passport. But the church leadership gets desperate and lies about the financial health of the church congregation to sell those bonds to the community. Are they immune from prosecution just because they are a church?
Pause and think about it. No. Remember the ironclad rule of fraud. Anti-fraud rules always apply, even to churches, even to charities. If you lie to sell a security, Prudent Penny will come for you, halo or no halo.
Fraud is fraud. And finally, employee benefit plans. This includes investment contracts issued in connection with an employee stock purchase plan, a savings plan, a pension, or a profit-sharing plan.
If Frank the founder decides to actually run a legitimate business and wants to give his loyal employees stock options or a pension plan, those securities are exempt. But there is a procedural trick you have to memorize for the exam.
What's the trick?
The trick is timing. The exemption only applies if the administrator is notified in writing exactly 30 days before the inception of the plan. You cannot just launch the employee stock plan today and tell Prudent Penny about it next month.
It's a permission slip you have to turn in a month early. If you launch it on day 29, it's not exempt.
Exactly.
All right, take a breath. That thoroughly covers the passports. We know what securities are inherently exempt. Governments, Canada, banks, insurance stocks, commercial paper with a bouncer, nonprofits, and 30-day employee plans. But now we have to flip the script entirely.
Now we enter the transaction side.
So we've established that some securities are born with a passport. But Frank's dog hoverboard startup stock definitely does not have one. It is a wildly risky, unregistered corporate equity. If Frank's early investors ever want to legally resell their non-exempt shares to a neighbor without triggering a regulatory nightmare, how do they do it? They need a loophole. And that brings us to the exempt transactions, the backstage passes.
Remember the analogy. An exempt transaction is all about how the security is sold, who is selling it to whom, and under what circumstances. And the exemption only applies to that single specific event. The backstage pass gets torn up the moment the trade settles.
Let's start with the most common category of exempt transactions, non-issuer transactions. This terminology trips people up. Let's define it clearly. What makes a transaction a non-issuer transaction?
It is actually incredibly simple, even though the exam tries to wrap it in dense legalese. A non-issuer transaction just means the issuer, the actual company that originally created the stock, does not get any of the money from the sale.
So if I open my brokerage app right now and buy one share of Apple stock, Apple Inc. does not get my $150. Some random guy in Ohio who decided to sell his share gets my money. That is the non-issuer transaction.
Exactly. It is the secondary market. Almost every trade you do on a normal basis is a non-issuer transaction. The company itself is entirely uninvolved.
So the most basic exempt transaction designed for normal people is the isolated non-issuer transaction.
Right. This is the garage sale exemption.
Let's bring Dave back. Let's say Dave bought some stock in a small, local, unregistered company a few years ago, maybe a local hardware store. He is washing his car in his driveway one Saturday. His neighbor walks over, they start talking, and Dave says, "Hey, I own some shares in the local hardware store. You want to buy them from me for $500? The neighbor says, "Sure," they shake hands and do the deal right there in the driveway.
That is perfectly legal. It is an isolated non-issuer transaction. Let's check the boxes. Okay. Dave is not the issuer. He doesn't benefit the hardware store by selling his personal property. And it is isolated, meaning it's a one-off, infrequent, occasional event.
Prudent Penny does not care about Dave's driveway conversation. But let's say Dave decides he really likes this feeling of being a financier. The next weekend, Dave brings a folding table out to the driveway. He puts up a little handwritten sign. He sells some more shares to the postman on Tuesday. On Thursday, he sells some to the guy delivering a pizza. He does this with 20 different people over the course of a month.
Now, Dave has a massive legal problem. The exam trap here hinges on the legal definition of isolated. If Dave starts doing this regularly, it is no longer isolated. It has become a pattern of recurring transactions.
Why does the folding table destroy the exemption?
Right.
Why does the state care if he sells to one person or 20?
Because of the psychology of the retail market. The isolated transaction rule exists simply to let ordinary citizens sell their private property without having to hire a legal team to file registration statements. It's practical. But the moment it becomes a pattern, Dave is effectively operating an unregistered secondary market out of his garage.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, he's acting like an unlicensed broker-dealer, facilitating a distribution of unregistered securities. The state wants to force volume trading onto regulated exchanges where there is actual transparency.
So the moment it's a pattern, the backstage pass is revoked, and Dave is committing a felony. Don't be a driveway broker, Dave.
Yeah.
Okay, what if a broker-dealer wants to trade an unregistered security in the secondary market? They can't use the isolated exemption because they trade every day. That brings us to the manual exemption. This requires jumping through some serious transparency hoops.
The manual exemption allows registered broker-dealers to legally sell outstanding securities in the secondary market if very specific public information conditions are met. Specifically, the security must have been outstanding in the hands of the public for at least 90 days.
Let's pause there. Why 90 days? That feels arbitrary.
It's not. It is designed to prevent hot issues from bypassing state registration immediately after an initial public offering, or IPO. If a company goes public and isn't federally covered, the state wants a 90-day cooling-off period where the market can digest the reality of the company before brokers start furiously trading it under an exemption.
Okay, so 90 days in the public's hands. What else?
Second, the issuer must be an actual operating company. No blank check companies, no blind pools, no shell corporations. They must be engaged in actual business.
Hold on. For the sake of clarity, define those terms. When you say blank check company, you literally mean a company that goes to the public and says, give us a bunch of money. We don't have a business plan or a product yet, but trust us, we will find something cool to buy later.
Yes, that is exactly what a blank check company or a special purpose acquisition company, a SPAC, is. And a blind pool is similar. It's a company that raises money without specifying what the funds will be used for. State regulators absolutely hate these. They view them as highly speculative and prone to fraud. So if a company's a blind pool, it can never qualify for the manual exemption.
So Frank the founder, if he just incorporated yesterday and has no product, no business plan, just a crayon drawing of a dog on a hoverboard, his stock would not qualify as an operating business.
Correct. And finally, the big requirement, the reason it's called the manual exemption, is that the company's detailed financial information, names of officers, audited balance sheets, income statements, must be published in a nationally recognized securities manual that Prudent Penny has approved.
With Standard & Poor's or Moody's.
Right. Or filed electronically on the SEC's DGR system. It's all about public transparency. If the financial anatomy of the company is fully visible in a recognized manual, the state feels the public has enough information to make an informed decision, so they grant the backstage pass for secondary trading.
Transparency equals exemption. Now, there is a very similar exemption for what we call senior securities.
Right. If a company has a security that is senior in rank to its common stock, like preferred stock or a corporate bond, it can be traded in an exempt non-issuer transaction if it has been outstanding for at least 3 years and the company has not defaulted on any dividend or interest payments in that entire three-year period.
It's basically a track record of reliability. You paid your bills flawlessly for 3 years, you get the backstage pass to be traded.
Exactly. It shows financial stability.
Okay, we've covered Dave and his driveway and broker's reading manuals. Let's look at transactions that are exempt based on who initiates them or who is buying them. Let's talk about unsolicited transactions. I genuinely love this one because it really captures the chaotic nature of human behavior.
Unsolicited means the retail customer initiated the trade entirely on their own. The broker did not suggest it, push it, advertise it, or recommend it in any way.
Let's set the scene. It's 2 a.m. on a Tuesday. Dave is wide awake, scrolling through some weird financial conspiracy forums on the internet. He goes down an absolute rabbit hole and decides, with 100% certainty that you must buy shares in an obscure, completely unregistered company that claims to be mining asteroids for lithium. He calls up Reckless Rick at 8 a.m. and says, "Rick, I need 1,000 shares of Asteroid Mining Corp immediately." Rick hasn't said a single word. He's just drinking his coffee.
Because Dave initiated it, because Dave brought the idea to the table unprompted, this is an exempt transaction. It is an unsolicited, non-issuer transaction executed through a registered broker-dealer.
But wait, Rick is involved. If Rick is a registered broker-dealer, he can just execute a trade for a totally unregistered, sketchy asteroid company.
Yes, but only because it was unsolicited. The philosophy here is that the state cannot protect Dave from his own 2 a.m. internet research. If a grown adult demands to buy a specific asset without any prodding from a financial professional, the state allows the broker to execute the trade.
Got it.
But if Rick had called Dave at 2 a.m. and pitched the asteroid company, that would be a solicited trade, the exemption would vanish instantly, and Rick would be guilty of selling an unregistered security.
Okay, I have a massive problem with this. What is to stop Rick from just calling Dave, aggressively pitching him this garbage asteroid stock, convincing him to buy it, and then when Prudent Penny investigates, Rick just lies and says, "Hey, I didn't pitch it. Dave called me. It was totally unsolicited. It's a he said, she said."
The regulators are way ahead of you on that. They know human nature. Prudent Penny has the explicit statutory authority to require Dave to sign a specific written acknowledgement form proving that the trade was, in fact, unsolicited.
Oh, so Dave has to put it in writing.
Yes. And Rick, the broker dealer, is legally required to keep that signed form in his files for years. If Penny comes knocking and asks to see the proof that it was unsolicited and Rick doesn't have Dave's signature, Rick is going down.
Paper trails. They always get you with the paper trails. It forces the broker to cover their own tracks.
Okay, moving on. Fiduciaries and pledges. Let's talk about secured debt first. There is a rule here I call the don't split the baby rule.
This deals with debt secured by real estate. When you have a bond or a note that is secured by a mortgage or a deed of trust on a property, the transaction is exempt, but only under one very specific unbreakable condition.
Yeah, sell the whole thing together.
Exactly. The entire mortgage, along with all the bonds secured by it, must be offered and sold as a single undivided unit.
So if Reckless Rick gets his hands on a massive $2 million mortgage bond backed by a commercial building, and he thinks, "I can't sell a $2 million bond to Dave, but I could slice it up into 20$100,000 pieces and sell them to 20 different retail investors." The moment he slices it, the exemption is gone. He split the baby. It must be sold as a single unit to a single buyer. The state doesn't want brokers creating unregulated, complex, fractionalized real estate derivatives for retail investors.
What about fiduciaries, like a county sheriff, an executor of an estate, or a bankruptcy trustee?
If a legally authorized fiduciary has to sell stock as part of their official court-appointed duties, say, liquidating an estate to pay heirs after someone passes away, or a bankruptcy trustee selling off a failed company's assets to pay creditors, those sales are exempt.
That makes intuitive sense. They aren't Wall Street sharks trying to pump and dump. They are just clearing out the attic because a judge told them to. But what about a pledge? Let's say Dave wants to buy a luxury yacht. He goes to the bank for a loan and he puts up $1 million of unregistered restricted stock as collateral.
First, just pledging the stock as collateral is not considered a sale, so we don't even need an exemption yet. But let's say Dave defaults on his yacht loan 6 months later. The bank legally seizes the collateral, the unregistered stock, and sells it on the open market to get their money back. That liquidation sale by the bank is an exempt transaction. It's called a bona fide pledge exemption.
Okay, bona fide meaning genuine. So Reckless Rick couldn't just invent a fake loan scheme to bypass the rules.
Correct. Rick couldn't have Dave take out a loan, default on it 5 minutes later by design, and use the bank to wash the unregistered stock into the market. The rule explicitly says it must be a genuine pledge made in good faith, without any purpose of evading the Securities Act. If Prudent Penny sees a loan default on day two, she's going to launch a fraud investigation.
She is not easily fooled. Okay, the last major category in this transaction section, institutional buyers.
This is often referred to in the industry as the big boy exemption. If you are offering or selling securities to banks, insurance companies, pension trusts, investment companies, or other broker dealers, the transaction is completely exempt.
I want to stop and ask why. Why is the law so strict when selling to Dave in his driveway, but completely hands-off when selling to a massive Wall Street bank?
Because you have to remember the entire philosophical purpose of the Uniform Securities Act. It exists to protect Dave. It exists to protect the retail investor who might not have the financial literacy, the resources, or the legal team to fully vet a complex investment.
Dave is vulnerable.
Dave is vulnerable, but a multinational bank, an insurance conglomerate, a billion-dollar pension fund. They have entire floors of lawyers, forensic accountants, and financial analysts. They are sophisticated. They can fend for themselves. If they want to buy a risky, unregistered security, the state says, go ahead. You are big boys. You don't need Prudent Penny to hold your hand and read the prospectus to you.
So Frank, the founder, can literally walk into the headquarters of a massive bank, pitch his dog hoverboards, and sell them $10 million in completely unregistered stock. And it's totally legal.
Perfectly legal. It is an exempt transaction because the buyer is an institution.
But what if that bank turns around the very next day, breaks that $10 million block of stock up, and starts selling it to Dave and his neighbors?
That is the trap. That is exactly what the exam will test you on. The exemption only covered the initial sale to the institution. Remember our analogy. The backstage pass only works for one night, for one person. When the bank tries to resell that unregistered stock to Dave, a retail investor, that is a brand new transaction.
And since Dave is not an institution, the big boy exemption does not apply.
Exactly. The bank cannot act as a washing machine. You cannot use an institution to launder an unregistered security into the retail market. The bank would need to find a new exemption for the sale to Dave or formally register the stock, or else they are committing an illegal sale.
That is a phenomenal conceptual framework. Okay, take a breath. We have covered a massive amount of ground. We are now entering one of the most highly tested, heavily scrutinized areas of the exam.
We need to talk about how startups actually raise money in the real world without breaking the law.
I want to do a pattern interrupt here. Listeners, focus up. We're going to do a direct side-by-side comparison of the two most confused exemptions on the entire exam. Private placements versus pre-organization certificates.
Candidates mix these up constantly because they sound similar. There are both ways for small companies to raise capital without going public. But the rules are critically, mechanically different.
Let's ditch the textbook definitions and use a real-world analogy. Think of a pre-organization certificate like a Kickstarter campaign for a product that doesn't exist yet. And think of a private placement like a velvet rope VIP room at an exclusive club that is already open and operating. Let's start with the VIP room, the private placement, also known as a limited offering.
Okay, setting the scene. Frank, the founder, actually has his company up and running. It is incorporated. He has a prototype dog hoverboard. But he needs a quick influx of cash to start manufacturing. He doesn't want to go public. He wants to do a private placement. What are the rules for the VIP room?
Rule one is the numbers game.
Yes. Frank can direct offers to a maximum of 10 persons in the state during any 12 consecutive month period.
I want to emphasize the specific word you just used, offers. I'm asking you, the listener, right now, put yourself in this scenario. Frank, the founder, creates a beautiful, glossy pitch deck for his hoverboards. He emails it out to 11 wealthy people in his state on a Tuesday. Over the next month, 9 of them reject him. Only 2 of them actually decide to buy the stock. Does Frank successfully qualify for the private placement exemption?
Take a second to think about the wording.
The answer is absolutely, unequivocally no.
Frank blew the exemption the second he hit send on that 11th email.
But I want to push back on this. Why? Only 2 people actually bought it. Why does the state care how many people he emailed if no money changed hands? That feels incredibly pedantic.
It's not about the money. It's about the broadcast. The limit is strictly on offerees, not purchasers. The state's philosophy is that an unregistered security is inherently dangerous to the public. They do not want you broadcasting it. The moment you start offering it to 11, 20, 50 people, you are acting like a public offering without the public protections. The state caps the offers to force you to be highly targeted and private.
That is a brutal exam trap. 10 offerees, not purchasers.
Yeah.
Okay, what are the other rules for the VIP room?
Rule 2 is no commissions or remuneration can be paid for soliciting any retail buyer. Frank cannot hire Reckless Rick and say, hey, Rick, I'll give you a 10% cut of the cash for every retail investor you convince to come into the VIP room.
So you can't incentivize brokers to push private stock on retail clients. Got it. What's the third rule?
Rule 3 is the seller must reasonably believe that all the retail buyers are purchasing for investment purposes.
What does investment purposes actually mean in reality?
It means they have investment intent. They aren't planning to act as undercover underwriters. Frank has to believe that Dave is buying the stock to hold it, not to flip it to his neighbor the very next day. Often, Frank will make Dave sign an investment letter acknowledging this, which is why this is sometimes called letter stock.
Okay, so 10 offerees, no retail commissions, investment intent required. Are there any exceptions to that 10-person limit?
Yes, and this ties perfectly back to what we just discussed. Institutional buyers, the banks, the pension funds, they do not count toward the 10-person limit.
Oh, so Frank could pitch his private placement to 9 retail investors and 50 different massive hedge funds, and he is still perfectly under the limit.
Exactly. Because institutional buyers don't need the retail protection, they aren't capped. You can invite as many institutions into the VIP room as you want. And finally, you should know that Prudent Penny has the power to issue a rule to increase or decrease that 10-person retail limit if she feels it's necessary for her specific state.
Okay, that is the private placement, the velvet rope VIP room. Now, let's look at the other side of the coin. Pre-organization certificates, the Kickstarter campaign.
A pre-organization certificate happens way earlier in the timeline of a business. Frank, the founder, hasn't even incorporated his business yet. He has a crazy idea in his head. But he wants to see if anyone is actually willing to fund a dog hoverboard before he spends $5,000 on filing fees and lawyers to officially create the corporation.
He's just trying to get commitments. It's exactly like Kickstarter. You pledge money to a project, but the project doesn't even exist yet.
Exactly. Because the timeline is different, the rules are fundamentally different. Rule one is the maximum number is 10 subscribers.
Wait, subscribers?
Yeah.
Not offerees.
Right. This is the crucial distinction. With a pre-organization certificate, Frank can publicly advertise. He can take out a billboard on the highway. He can post on social media to 1 million people saying, "Who wants to back my hoverboard idea?" The limit is not on who hears the offer. The limit is that no more than 10 people can actually sign the subscription agreement.
So let me drill this in. 10 offerees for private placements. 10 subscribers for pre-organizations.
Do not mix those up on exam day. Rule two for pre-organizations is no commissions allowed for soliciting subscribers. That is the same as private placements. But here is the massive knockout blow for the Kickstarter analogy. Rule three is absolutely no payments can be made by any subscriber.
Wait, hold on. Frank gets 10 people to sign a piece of paper subscribing to his idea, but they can't actually hand him a check.
Not a single dime, not 1 cent can change hands.
Then what is the point? How does he build the company?
The entire purpose of this exemption is just to gauge interest and secure legal commitments. Once Frank gets his 10 subscribers on paper, he knows he has the financial backing. Then he takes those pledges to the bank, or he goes and officially incorporates the business.
Ah.
Once the business legally exists, the pre-organization phase is over. Now, to actually collect the money they pledged, Frank has to either fully register the stock, or more likely, he transitions them into a private placement exemption in order to legally accept the cash.
It's literally a pledge. I promise to give you money once you are a real company. But the state absolutely will not let you take their cash while you are just an idea on a napkin.
If Frank takes even a $5 bill from a subscriber under a pre-organization certificate, the exemption is dead and he is violating the law.
That is fascinating. The state allows you to test the waters publicly, but they won't let you drown the investors' money until you have a real ship built.
That is a perfect way to visualize it.
Let's briefly touch on two other very specific exemptions in this section before we move to the final boss. Existing holders and pre-effective offers.
If a company wants to offer more stock to people who already own their stock, this is typically called a rights offering. It is an exempt transaction, provided they don't pay commissions to anyone for soliciting those stockholders.
That makes total sense. The investors already know the company. They already hold the stock. They don't need a new layer of protection to buy more of it.
Exactly. But they are allowed to pay a standby commission to an underwriter. Basically, an underwriter says, "We will buy any leftover shares that your current stockholders don't want for a flat fee." That fee is permitted.
And what about pre-effective offers? Where does this fit in the timeline?
This happens when a massive company is actually going public. They are doing an IPO. They have filed registration statements with the SEC under the Securities Act of 1933, and they have filed with Prudent Penny under the Uniform Securities Act. But they are in what's called the cooling off period. They are just waiting for the paperwork to clear and become officially effective.
During that waiting period, what can they actually do?
They can offer the security to the public, but they absolutely cannot sell it yet. They can distribute a red herring prospectus, which is a preliminary document with red text on it saying it's not final, to drum up interest and gather indications of interest.
So brokers can build a list of people who want to buy, but no money changes hands.
Right. no sales until the registration is officially effective. And this exemption only works if Prudent Penny hasn't issued a stop order halting the whole process because she found something suspicious in the paperwork.
Okay, we have survived the transactional maze. We know the difference between the velvet rope, which is 10 offerees, payment allowed, and the Kickstarter, which is 10 subscribers, no payment. We are heading into the final stretch, and this is where things get slightly intimidating.
The administrator's hammer, denial and revocation.
We've spent this entire hour talking about all these exemptions, these passports and backstage passes. Now we need to talk about Prudent Penny's actual power to rip them away. Can the administrator just wake up on a Tuesday in a bad mood, decide she doesn't like Frank, and revoke any exemption she wants?
No. Her powers are incredibly broad, but they are not absolute. There is a highly specific, fixed list of what she can and cannot touch.
Let's start with what she can't touch. The immune list. The untouchables. These are the exemptions that Prudent Penny can never revoke, no matter how egregious the situation might seem.
The exam will test your memory of this list. She could have Frank dead to rights on a technicality, and she still couldn't revoke the exemption itself.
Now remember, she could still arrest him for fraud. The anti-fraud rule always applies. But she cannot strip the security of its underlying exempt status. What is on the immune list?
Government securities, so U.S., municipal, and foreign governments with relations, bank securities, insurance company securities, credit union securities, public utilities, and commercial paper.
Government, financial institutions, and commercial paper.
Uh-huh.
They're completely bulletproof from a state administrator's revocation power. If it's a U.S. Treasury bond, Prudent Penny cannot declare it non-exempt.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a bank stock, she cannot revoke its exemption.
But then we have the revocable list, the targets. These are the specific exemptions she does have the statutory power to deny or revoke if she believes the public is at risk. For exempt securities, the passports, she can only revoke three categories: exchange-listed securities, nonprofits, and employee benefit plans.
I want to stop and point out a massive philosophical contradiction here, and I want you to explain it. Why can Prudent Penny revoke the exemption of a local church building fund, a nonprofit, but she is legally barred from revoking the exemption of a massive corporation's commercial paper? That seems completely backwards. The church is local, the corporation is huge.
It is entirely about federalism, the supremacy clause, and interstate commerce. Commercial paper, bank stocks, and government bonds are macroeconomic instruments. They move across state lines constantly. They are regulated by massive federal apparatuses, the Federal Reserve, the SEC, the Treasury.
Right.
If a single state administrator in one small state could suddenly revoke the exempt status of a Fortune 500 company's commercial paper, it would cause chaos in the national banking system. The federal government basically preempts the state from messing with those macro instruments.
I see.
But a local church, a local charity, a local employee benefit plan. Those are highly localized state-level entities. The state administrator retains full jurisdiction to revoke their exemptions because regulating them doesn't disrupt the national economy.
That makes perfect sense. Okay, so for securities, she can only revoke nonprofits, employee plans, and exchange listed. What about transactions, the backstage passes?
She can revoke all exempt transactions, every single one of them.
Wait, really?
Yes. Isolated non-issuer. Revocable. Unsolicited trades. Revocable. Private placements. Revocable. Institutional buyers. Revocable. All of the backstage passes can be torn up by Prudent Penny at any time.
Wow. Passports are mostly immune, but backstage passes are totally at her mercy. But she can't just act like a dictator, right? She can't just tweet out a revocation and shut down a business.
Correct. The U.S. Constitution still applies. She has to follow a strict due process sequence. If she wants to revoke an exemption, she must provide three things. Number one, prior written notice to all interested parties. Number two, an opportunity for a formal hearing. And number three, written findings of fact and conclusions of law explaining exactly why she did it.
Notice, hearing, written findings. But wait, let's look at the real world. What if Prudent Penny is investigating Reckless Rick and she realizes he is actively selling a completely bogus nonprofit security right this very second? Investors are losing tens of thousands of dollars by the minute. If she has to wait for a formal hearing, which could take weeks, the damage is done. Does she have to wait?
No, she has a powerful tool called a summary order. She can act summarily, which legally means immediately, without a prior hearing to deny or revoke an exemption pending a final decision. She signs the paper, and the stop order goes into effect that exact second.
But she still owes them due process eventually, right?
Mm-hmm.
The Constitution doesn't just disappear because she's in a hurry.
Exactly. A summary order does not cancel due process. It just defers it to stop the immediate bleeding. After issuing the summary order, she must promptly notify everyone affected that the order was entered and the reasons why. If Reckless Rick receives the order and wants to fight it, he submits a written request for a hearing. Once Penny receives that written request, she is legally required by statute to set a hearing within 15 days.
Okay, what if Rick knows he's guilty of sin, knows he's caught, and just doesn't ask for a hearing?
Then the summary order just stays in effect forever until Penny decides to modify or vacate it.
Now, let's talk about the time travel trap. I love this concept because it tests the fundamental fairness of the law. Let's say Dave executed a perfectly legal, isolated, non-issuer transaction in his driveway on a Monday. He sold some stock to his neighbor. The exemption was totally valid at the time.
Okay, perfectly legal.
Right. But on Wednesday, prudent Penny discovers a larger fraud issue with the company and revokes all exempt transactions for that specific stock. Can she go back in time, apply the revocation retroactively, and declare Dave's trade from Monday illegal?
Never. A denial or revocation order can never operate retroactively. It only applies going forward. Dave's trade on Monday remains perfectly lawful. You cannot be punished for breaking a rule that did not exist when you acted.
Okay, listener, here is a direct question for you. Put yourself in Dave's shoes. Prudent Penny issues the revocation order on Wednesday morning. It's a public record. On Thursday afternoon, Dave, who hasn't watched the news, hasn't checked his mail, and has no idea what is going on, sells more of that stock to a different friend, assuming the driveway exemption is still valid. Is Dave guilty of an unregistered, unlawful security sale, even though he honestly, genuinely didn't know about the order?
I want you to really think about the difference between being unaware and being careless.
The answer depends entirely on the good faith defense. Dave can defend himself in court, but he has a very high bar to clear. He has to prove two distinct things.
First, he must prove he genuinely did not know of the order.
Okay, that's simple ignorance. I didn't know.
But in the eyes of the law, simple ignorance fails. It is not enough. He must also prove that in the exercise of reasonable care, he could not have known of the order.
Let's define reasonable care.
If Prudent Penny published the revocation order in the major local newspaper, sent blast emails to all registered brokers in the state, and posted it in massive red letters on the front page of the state regulatory website, and Dave just stands before the judge and says, "Well, Your Honor, I don't read the news and I don't check websites," that is legal negligence.
The good faith defense does not excuse negligence.
Exactly. He has to prove he acted with reasonable care, that he took normal precautions, and still couldn't have known. If he's negligent, he is guilty of an unlawful transaction on Thursday, regardless of his actual knowledge.
That is a brilliant legal standard. You cannot just bury your head in the sand and claim innocence.
Ignorance of the law is not a defense if the ignorance is born from laziness.
Well, we have made it. We have traversed the muddy waters, we've met the characters, we've learned the rules, and we've survived the traps. It is time for our rapid-fire recap.
Let's rattle off the top testable takeaways from everything we've discussed today. Drill these into your short-term memory. Number one, the anti-fraud rule applies to absolutely everything. Exempt securities, exempt transactions, registered, federal covered. Fraud is always fraud, and Prudent Penny always has jurisdiction.
Number two, financial institutions. Banks acting as mere conduits, just holding stuff in a vault, are not exempt. The bank has to actually be on the hook for the debt. And insurance companies, remember the insurance riddle, their corporate stocks and bonds are exempt, but variable annuities and variable life insurance are not exempt. They shift the risk to the investor, so they must be registered.
Number three, commercial paper needs to hit the three-part bouncer checklist simultaneously. A minimum of $50,000 denomination to keep retail investors out, 9 months or less to maturity, and a top three rating. Miss even one, and you're bounced.
Number four, the capital raising comparison. Private placements, which is the VIP room, are capped at 10 offerees in a year, and institutional buyers do not count toward that cap. Pre-organization certificates, which is the Kickstarter, are capped at 10 subscribers, and you absolutely, unequivocally cannot take any payment until the company is officially registered or finds another exemption.
Number five, the administrator's hammer. Prudent Penny cannot revoke the exemptions for macroeconomic instruments like government, financial institution, or commercial paper securities. She can revoke highly localized things like exchange-listed, nonprofits, employee benefit plans, and all exempt transactions. And finally, she can act summarily, but she can never, ever apply a revocation retroactively.
That is a dense, heavy pack of knowledge. But if you keep the underlying logic in mind, if you remember why the rules exist, to protect Dave while letting massive banks function smoothly, you could figure out almost any trick question they throw at you on the exam.
Exactly. Understanding the why is your absolute best defense against exam traps. You aren't just memorizing, you are thinking like a regulator.
Before we wrap up, I want to leave you with a provocative thought to mull over as you study. Throughout this entire deep dive, we've drawn a very hard, fixed line between what a security is, the passport, and how it is sold, the backstage pass.
It is the absolute foundation of state regulations. The two are distinct.
But look at the direction the financial world is moving right now. In an era where digital tokens, blockchain assets, and global smart contract crowdfunding platforms can instantly shift an asset from a tiny, isolated private transaction into a massive global retail market overnight, how long can state laws actually keep these two categories separate? Think about it. The way a token operates on a blockchain, the transaction mechanism itself is often baked directly into the code of the asset. The transaction is the security. If a digital asset is programmed to automatically execute its own secondary market sales, does the backstage pass become the passport? How might the very nature of hyperliquid programmed transactions one day force regulators like Prudent Penny to completely redefine what a security actually is?
That is a regulatory nightmare waiting to happen. The old definitions are going to stretch until they break. Prudent Penny is definitely going to need a bigger hammer.
Something to ponder while you review your flashcards. You are now fully equipped to crush this section of the Series 63. Stay curious, keep studying, and we'll catch you on the next deep dive.